Excuse me, Supreme Leader.
Yes, what is it?
Some of the masses are upset that you executed your uncle.
I'm sorry, the who?
The masses, the workers.
Oh, the workers. I love the workers. I think that's what we want to emphasize here, how much I love the workers. And let's remind them of our new national motto. If you can't say something nice,
you'll be executed. Yes, I know. We put that one out today. But the people still seem restless.
Well, tell them not to be nattering North Koreans of negativity. Turn that Pyongyang frown upside down. What's that American song that we like?
Accentuate the positive.
Eliminate the negative. Latch on to the affirmative. And don't be a renegade, traitor dog, or you will be purged.
Exalted One, I'm not sure we can spin this event in the manner of which you speak.
What is it that Jiminy Cricket, chief insect of the Political Bureau of the Central Committee, tells us? A dream is a wish your heart makes.
That's actually from a different Disney movie, dear leader. And anyway, you had Jiminy Cricket executed last month.
Yeah, he attempted to overthrow the state through despicable methods, and that's not the kind of happy, productive, win-win, compromise-seeking place we want today. Let's announce that tomorrow is Funny Hat Day. All workers are going to wear funny hats.
Yeah, not going to work.
What you don't understand is the power of smarm. We can't go into an emotional tailspin every time I purge one of my relatives. So let's tell them that it's a happy thing because I say it's a happy thing. So put on happy faces and fake it till you make it. Speaking of which, we have a great show today because we love you listeners and we are crazy about this nose panel. We think it is the best one ever. We're talking about smarm versus snark. And now he thinks Carrie Underwood is so nice, she should do Sound of Music twice. Colin McEnroe.
All right. That was a very smarmy introduction. I want to welcome our panelists to the nose from Trinity College, Professor Irene Papoulis, from Trinity Cine Studio, James Handley, and from not from Trinity, but freelance writer and the genius behind The Cut, an online magazine for the young adults of Connecticut, Teresa Kramer. Before I say another word, I do have to sort of admit, and I think Wolfie's just putting on a brave face even through that intro, to I am, as Ebenezer Scrooge today, I am Cinderella's stepsisters, because today, right now, the big fancy company party, the annual Christmas party, is taking place at a nearby restaurant, and I made everybody do the show instead. And I don't necessarily feel good about it either, but it's going to be like hanging around as a subtext today, so you should understand that. I did it for you, listeners. I did it for you. So one of the things we – sort of the prism through which we're going to look at a lot of things is an essay by Tom Skoka. According to Gawker writer Tom Skoka, there's a world of darkness and a world of light, and we tend to get the two reversed. We've assigned the qualities of darkness to snark, a hostile, knowing, bitter tone of contempt, as one writer called it, and we associate lightness with pre-planned positivism, and the notion that we would be more productive and happy if we put that snark away. And so there's a consensus or something that has assumed the tone of consensus that we are living to our disadvantage. I think this is Skoka's writing. It doesn't sound like mine. This is a consensus or something that has assumed the tone of a consensus that we are living to our disadvantage in an age of snark, and that the problem of our times is a thing called snark. He thinks it's actually a thing called smarm, which is a sort of false positive virtuousness, he says, an assumption of the forms of seriousness, of virtue, of constructiveness, without the substance. Smarm is concerned with appropriateness and with tone. Bad things, bad people, smarmy people, as far as he's concerned, include Dave Eggers, maybe especially Dave Eggers, Ari Fleischer, Lanny Davis, book critics who have renounced the negative review in general, critic David Denby, historian Niall Ferguson, the website Upworthy, Malcolm Gladwell, and maybe especially the only person who comes off worse than Dave Eggers, maybe Joe Lieberman. I can read the quote later if anybody wants. And that's one of the reasons I got interested in this essay, I have to be honest. Good people who are sort of used snark well, Hunter Thompson, H.L. Mencken, Dorothy Parker, David Foster Wallace. These, of course, are the usual suspects for excellence in snark. So we're not even sure that we love this essay, but Teresa Kramer, no stranger to snark. I mean,
Nailed.
Yeah, right. Send us down some path or other. Where do you want to go with this essay?
Well, my last thought on this was that I blame hipsters and Jonathan Franzen for it all because they've attached – well, you can't like anything or dislike anything without being judged for it in one way or another, either through snark or through smarm. And smarm is just sort of judging of snarkiness, I guess. And so, you know, no matter what you like or don't like, someone out there is judging you for it, either harshly or in some sort of weird, happy way.
Well, I think one of the things, I mean, what's interesting about this Skoka essay, or maybe it's a problem with the Skoka essay, it sprawls all over the place. And it really, you know, it's as much cultural as it is political. It gets deeply into politics, or I actually don't think it gets deeply into anything, but it flirts intensely with politics. And it seems as though one of the arguments that he is making is that whole sense that we should smile a little bit more and argue a little bit less may, James, work to our detriment.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that actually there's such an incredible overbalance of smarm in so many ways. I mean, start from the commercial point of view. I mean, as somebody who works in the film industry, I mean, there's huge amounts of money ride on great waves of smarm about movies in advance that are intended to counter any possibility that maybe at the advanced screenings there were some critical things said. And I really think that we actually lack for the sharp snark in a sort of coherent form. Part of my problem with the essay, the Skoka essay, was that it was so large and so sprawling that it didn't really come to a sense of understanding about what he was actually trying to say. And so it tries to hit all the targets. And I think there is an important point there. And really, we do need people who are of wit, who can actually distill the snark to actually get to the point. And for instance, if you have like a piece of literature or a book that comes out or a film that comes out where there's a huge commercial wave riding behind it trying to make out that this is the best thing since whatever. And I mean, examples right now would be something like The Hobbit, for example, that, you know, this is a tiny, tiny text that has been expanded into massive 3-hour epics and it really – it deserves some criticism for that, but you need focused criticism, I think, that actually is somebody coming from a point of view of being able to explain it and sort of come up with the way of putting it out that you can actually feel you understood that. I feel with the Skoka essay it's like this enormous sort of trying to encapsulate everything and ends up at the end and I'm thinking, what?
By the way, before we hear from Irene Papoulos about this, our number 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Are we drowning in snark? Are we drowning in smarm? Do you not understand the premise?
Well, yeah, because the first thing about the essay that I really liked was the idea, because I've heard the idea and I've said it, you know, we're too cynical in our culture. We're too cynical. We're too snarky. We're not in touch with our own earnestness and our real vulnerability, et cetera, is a line of thinking that I've had, you know, quite a few times, even though I love snark in many ways. But I think there's something that it masks, you know. And so when he says, you know, instead of that, let's look to the real problem at something that he's calling smarm, which is sort of false to me. You know, to me, the thing that encapsulates it is the idea of false piety, you know, sort of an empty sense of generalized, you know, looking at people like, I can't believe they do it that way. Wait a minute. So it's how do we really define exactly what smarm is? I mean, I think it's true in criticism when you make overblown generalizations, but there's something about the empty rhetoric of, like, I was thinking in the academic world, the idea of rigor, you know, like, well, her class isn't really as rigorous as we might want it to be. There's something about rigor that's not defined clearly, but it's sort of a way to attack someone that is sort of underhandedly vicious, even though it claims to sort of be on the side of right and correctness.
Although I think Skoka asked the question, I think he frames the question, who's the real cynic here? Is the cynic the person who's pointing and saying, no, this isn't true, in fact, it's a load of crap? Or is the cynic the person who's smiling in a Joe Lieberman kind of way and saying, you know what, we really can get along just fine. Everybody has to kind of just sort of give up these hard-won principles that they're clinging to, you know, and then we'll be fine, you know. I mean, there really isn't that much to fight about, and we shouldn't be fighting. We should be the end, the goal should be some kind of comedy, as opposed to your principle being played out in reality.
So, is there an element of naivety in smarminess, or is it fake naivete, like, you know?
Well, if you think of something like, for instance, if you meet somebody who you read right away as figuring out how is he supposed to act, or how is he or she supposed to act to make you like them, and they're sort of actually, you know, before your very eyes, they're making that calculation and then they're acting that way, which to me is like one of the sort of bright lines of smarm kind of thing, that it's really creating a falsehood that you don't really know the person then, and you think that really they're not confident in themselves. And I think this whole thing about how people see cynicism, what is cynicism? I mean, cynicism in itself, you could say, is something that is really demeaning an object that maybe doesn't deserve it. But there's so many things that are deserving. This thing, Irene, that you raise about a class, you know, and rigor, and actually sort of how do you deal with a subject in class for real, and you feel that it's a rigorous study of it, and you can criticize it, but you also can hear the other side of it, and you can actually be real about it instead of just dismissing it. There is that thing that I think, you know, Teresa, you said about how, you know, the rapid sort of decision that somebody makes about whether something's real or it's not real, and whether you're past it, you know, whether you're showing that you haven't been paying attention. Part of the problem there is this rapid decision making, that all of these things are coming down the pike so fast that you have to make a really quick decision. Is this relevant? Is it making any point? Is it serious? And a cynical remark is a quick response that makes it look like you're very hip and that you're really okay. You can move fast on that and make that judgment. And it's the exact antithesis of what you were saying, Irene, about a class, about rigor, and about actually studying something or actually talking about something for real.
Got a call here from Ted in Guilford. Hi, Ted.
Hi. How are you guys?
Good. You're on the air.
Thanks. Snark, as far as I know, was invented by Lewis Carroll with his poem, and it's a fairly new word. And all these words are being used now on the internet to take over the place of perfectly good older words we used to use, like irony, facetiousness, and sarcasm. And I hope you guys will distinguish those three classical words in this discussion, but otherwise I'm enjoying it. Thanks very much.
Oh, thanks. See, I feel as though irony has been twisted around to mean something that it was never meant to mean.
Alanis Morissette's fault.
Yeah, I mean, it's largely Alanis Morissette's fault. But that might be a path we don't want to have the time to go down. It might be interesting to sort of look at some cases and point through this prism. Did you have one that you wanted to?
No, I wanted to ask for one, though.
Okay.
Because Joe Lieberman is a good example.
Well, Joe Lieberman's a good
perfect example.
A perfect example. We can certainly go there. But just for starters, one movie that I'm watching right now, I'm awaiting the release of, because I think it might be a really good exercise in this exact question, is this, I guess it's called Saving Mr. Banks. It's this Tom Hanks and Emma Thompson movie about the making of Mary Poppins. Now, I, as a child, grew up reading the P.L. Travers books, which are much darker, you know, and acknowledge sort of the weird thinking of children in an interesting way. And Mary Poppins have you read these books?
Yeah.
She's a distinctly uncharming figure too.
Yeah.
She's about as far from Julie Andrews as you could get. And this was really my watershed moment in the world of Snark versus Smarm, was when I was in fifth grade and that movie came out. And I was astonished. I was horrified by what had happened to these books. That they really, that all of the darkness and weirdness that I liked about these books had been absolutely sanitized and neutered and turned into something completely different, something that was falsely reassuring. It's like I understood Smarm in fifth grade thanks to Walt Disney.
Okay, so it's sort of like there's two ways to be smarmy then, because one is they're Mary Poppins the movie, you could say, was a smarmy version of the book, right? Would you say? But then there's something about being like sort of imposing your like a smarmy criticism of someone else, which is a different kind of smarm, right? Or I mean, isn't that also still smarm?
I think smarm would be someone suggesting that my anger about this movie is unproductive. That without seeing this movie and dismissing it as the kind of saccharine claptrap that condescends to children and dismisses some of their real kind of fears and weird concerns about life, you know, that my anger about this is misplaced, it's not productive, you know, people should just enjoy the movie and I should shut up.
Can't you just appreciate the value of it, they would say. So, but is that cynical? Well, is that a cynical?
I think that in a case like that, like with Mary Poppins, the fact is, I think that she had various arguments, which I guess some of which appear in this movie, in the new movie, Saving Mr. Banks. But I mean, she had some misgivings herself about what Walt Disney wanted to do. But Walt Disney, throughout his career, was about sort of reassurance, about nice, about, you know, sort of maybe just slightly shaking the orthodoxy, making a little bit of fear, but actually making it reassuring. And he was essentially, very talented though he may have been, he was selling a product. And the book that he chose to make this film from was something totally different. But he saw the potential to make it something more bland, something more reassuring in a basic way without having all of those underlying things. And I think it's an interesting thing that the caller who mentioned Lewis Carroll, I mean, the themes in Lewis Carroll are intensely disturbing and designed to sort of divert you from thinking you know what something means.
So the cynicism of smarminess comes in the sort of putting forth something that's bland as though it were real when in fact it's hiding the real thing.
Knowing that it's always
which is
more
a layer of irony, real irony.
Yeah. It's also knowing that it's always going to be more marketable.
Almost invariably will be
more marketable than anything that's either rigorous or disconcerting or upsetting.
Yeah.
Unless you have something to say about Mary Poppins, though, Teresa Kramer.
Well,
go ahead.
I was just wondering, does smarminess sort of seek to sort of rob people of their opinions? Like, is any opinion then sort of cynical, or unless you love everything, you can't have an opinion
on
it?
Any criticism?
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
I think you can use
Joe Lieberman in that way. Joe Lieberman at a certain point started taking the position that really arguing about the war in Iraq was counterproductive. And that what people really needed to do was kind of sit down and bury their differences. But that amounted to relinquishing your opinion.
Yeah.
Right. Well, right at the start of his career, he was always basically holding his finger to the wind and deciding, okay, what's the most milquetoast position to take that wouldn't involve taking a risk that might find him high and dry at some point. And so his career was based on that, and all of the things that he said later on were extensions of that.
And so you're saying he did that deliberately,
yes,
right?
Absolutely.
He sat down and said, "I'm gonna cover over what I really think about this."
Not necessarily that. It's like a person who actually tries to seek to please in a way. What is going to isolate you from the possibility of something troublesome or something that where somebody will actually criticize you or somebody will actually quarrel with you about your positions?
Yes,
I could do a 4-hour show about Joe Lieberman. I don't want to do that.
Okay, but there's unconscious smarm.
There's a famous story about Richelieu that's probably apocryphal, but supposedly there's fighting in the streets in Paris. And he and his cardinals and the king and whoever are wondering what's going on. And Richelieu, you know, comes in from the balcony and they say, well, who's winning? And he says, we are. And they say, well, what does that mean? And he goes, I don't know. I'm going to go down and find out.
Right.
You know, and that's sort of part of the key of smarm. You know you're winning.
Absolutely.
You just have to find out what that means and who you have to ally yourself with.
Okay, so it's always cynical then. I mean, is unconscious and therefore uncynical smarm possible?
Oh, I think so. I think there are people who do it. Yeah, I think there are people who do it without meaning to. But I want to go do another case in point. This is something that's been in the news a lot this week and last week in Trumbull at Trumbull High School. They wanted to stage Rent. The principal decided that Rent was I'm trying to not use those terms right now, but the Rent had too many problematic themes in it. He didn't want to do it. He canceled it. There was a huge pushback. It's now a national story. It's like in newspapers and magazines all over the country. Now they're trying to find some middle way of doing it, a way that the students and parents are finding very inconvenient, as though it didn't work out. It won't really work out for them very well. And there are sort of a lot of questions that I think go, Teresa, to that smirk.
We invented a new word.
Smirk, yeah. That's the middle ground. That's the third way is smirk. Snark and smarm continuum. I mean, in some ways, you could say, well, the principal is ultimately engaging in an act of smarm. He's saying, I'm concerned there's too many prickly things sticking out of this.
He's covering up the truth, basically.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. I don't know. I find this whole thing silly. As I said to you guys, I was in high school when Rent first came out. All my friends went to see it a million times. By the time it came out in the movies and I went to see it, I was like, wow, this is really dated and seemed really, I don't know, old, old-fashioned isn't the word, but I'm not coming up with a better word at the moment. And so the idea that that this high school principal doesn't think that his kids are well acquainted with every problematic theme in the musical is just silly. And he lives in the Disneyfied version of his town, apparently.
But, you know, building on what you said, and I'd love to hear you guys on this, it seems to me a darker and snarker approach to this would be, wow, you know, this isn't really all that dark a product. And it's about, I mean, if it's anything, it's an ode to kind of Dionysian behavior and bohemian wildness. And to get bogged down in this bureaucratic fight with your school principal about when, I mean, neither side really can claim to be subscribing to the ideas of the play at this point.
No, but the principal might be saying, I don't know enough about the story, but my sense might, you know, if it's unconscious on his part, if he really genuinely believed that there was something wrong with those themes for the school, then he's a good example of unconscious smarminess, you know, sort of saying that, no, we have to, you know, we have, you know, adolescence is a time when we have to not think about such things, you know, or something like that. But it doesn't make any sense. But that could be the motivation, right?
I don't know. It's inexplicable to me why certain people pick things like that. You know, like they you would think that a person who was in that position would think about the consequences of taking on something like that, which is not his responsibility. He doesn't clearly understand. He doesn't have a connection with the young people he's supposedly managing or guiding. He's so totally out of touch. I mean, I'm reminded of sometimes, you know, over the years at Cine Studio, we've had people come to us in various guises about the inappropriateness of showing films. Believe it or not, during the days of Jerry Lewis movie theaters, which were by contract only allowed to show G-rated movies, I think that lasted for about 3 weeks. But the point about that was that there were these people who felt that you could really manage this and you could say, well, okay, a G-rated, the MPAA decides that that's suitable for everybody and that's what we want to show. We want the sort of happy thing to be shown, and that anything that and we would be showing something, you know, that was critical, something that might be uncomfortable, that actually makes people uncomfortable, which after all is can be one of the most thrilling experiences of art. And young people in a high school want to learn things like that. And yet there are people who set themselves up. And I think it's a particularly pernicious kind of smarm that says that I know better, and that very often these people are not well-read. They haven't had much experience. They just have a kind of chutzpah about what they think should be the case without any evidence whatsoever.
Well, if it started as an act of unconscious smarm, I think it's become an act of conscious smarm. And part of the principal's argument now is we need a period of education about this. We need to set up programs with everybody from the Anti-Defamation League to God knows who, so that everybody understands what all the social issues are and that those social issues aren't encountered in something other than some highly structured way. Although it seems to me that whatever the issues are in Rent, there are things that shouldn't be encountered in a highly structured way if they're worth encountering at all.
It just seems silly to me that he thinks they haven't already been encountered. Like, these kids have probably already seen the play or seen the movie. They've, you know, my graduation was filled with songs from Rent. So, you know, it just seems...
And look how you turned out.
Yeah, I know.
Very
this
snarky.
This is what happens when you sing...
Troublesome
you know,
boy presents.
Seasons of Love a thousand times.
All right, let me grab a call from Michelle in Simsbury. Hi, Michelle, you're on the air.
Hi.
Go ahead. Fire away.
Well, I am. I would consider myself a snarky person, and the thing I'm forced to confront these days is I have an 11-year-old son, and he's turning out to be not just snarky but cynical. And I find myself saying to him, "You're too young to be this cynical about whatever." And so it's forced me to kind of step back and look at how I react to the world. Because I'm really not sure if I want to put my 11-year-old out there being...
It's a great point. It's a great point that you're making. Yeah. I mean, do you have any... Can you think off the top of your head of any examples of ways in which he's becoming too snarky and cynical?
Well, we were watching TV one day, and there was an ad on for Christian Mingle. And he's like, and he started being really sarcastic about it. And I had to stop and talk to him and say, you know, for people whose faith is that central to their lives... Maybe it's good that they have this forum to find someone who shares their, you know, their belief system.
True.
And, but we're not a religious family, but even at 11, I think he recognizes smarm and insincerity. But I think at 11, when he's interacting with people out in the world, I'm not always sure I want him to sound that kind of smug out there.
It's just a sad that he's too young to date Teresa Kramer.
Yeah.
sitting around making fun of the Christian mingle, I had to be like that.
That's my average Saturday night.
go ahead.
No, but I think that to me, that idea of being 11 years old and learning those lessons, that's exactly what you need to be really parsing about what's going on around you, is having a sense of what is, the uses of cynicism and maybe having that conversation. That's great to have that conversation.
Would you rather send your kid out as sort of this naive piece of veal into the world or as the kid who's like, the Christian mingle people are a little creepy? I'd take that kid any day of the week because he probably won't get robbed.
There's something I want to stick up for earnestness, though. Because, I love – snarkiness is great, but earnestness is too, and I think that's what the caller was trying to say. So, I agree that talking to the 11-year-old about that would be really interesting because I think, 11-year-olds and maybe all of us have earnestness somewhere, and sometimes snark covers it up because we're afraid of it, and it is important to take seriously.
Yeah, there is sort of a Promethean moment when every child discovers the snark view of things, and it's a sad thing if you're a parent, that moment, because first of all, it's Promethean in the sense that it's all they want to indulge in for a while, too.
Right.
Everything is fake. Everything is stupid. Everything that they ever held dear, they suddenly realize, is a complete travesty.
Isn't that an absolutely essential part of passage of growing up?
But it's still sad.
And some people never get over it, and that's really sad.
That's true. But I think that it could be worse if you were totally sheltered from it and, you were punished for snark or something like that, and you thought, you always had to, It's kind of like the scene that was mentioned, about Thumper in Bambi.
Yeah.
Mother makes him say, that thing about not saying, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. But it's his mother who makes him say it.
That's horrible.
And he looks really resentful.
That's worse for kids. I agree.
All right. We have to stop now. I have to say, the saddest moment in literature is when Benji says, "Caddy doesn't smell like trees anymore," in The Sound and Fury. And that kind of is that sort of moment, though things are not what I thought they were. All right. We have to take a little break. We'll come back. Maybe you just heard the worst day of your life. But there's no escape and there's no excuse. So just suck up and be nice. Be nice. Be nice. Be nice. All right, we're back. This is The Nose. With us, Irene Babulis, James Hanley, and Teresa Kramer. We've been talking about snark and smarm, and I'd love to just quickly sort of end that conversation. These two things don't button together all that well. But Time has announced its person of the year. It's Pope Francis. And there has been immediately this kind of drumbeat about Edward Snowden, that everybody has decided. I don't know if this is something Time revealed, like who the first runner-up was. But everybody has decided this really comes down to Edward Snowden versus Pope Francis. And that there is a certain drumbeat out there that it should have been Edward Snowden. I've got some quotes here from a Daily Beast piece if anybody needs to hear them. But you were saying somebody thought, said Time kind of lucked out by having somebody besides Edward Snowden they could pick?
Yeah, because any other year you could never have said any. You couldn't have pushed him to the side, really, except that there happened to be a pope who was doing semi-interesting things, so they could put him on the cover instead and not anger the government.
And do you think it should have been Edward Snowden?
Probably. I think that he probably actually enacted more change. More change came out of him than, the Pope's going around saying a lot of things and nothing's really happening. So what's more interesting, someone who says things or someone who actually does things?
Yeah. Our number on this, if you want to call real fast, we can't stay with the conversation long, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Actually, I'm prepared to stick up for the Pope, but James, I sense that you're not.
Well, no, I totally agree it should have been Edward Snowden. But, the Time magazine is a fairly conservative
smarmy
magazine. And the thing that I do feel is about doing rather than talking, absolutely. Snowden's life has been upended by what has actually revealed to us something that some may have suspected, but it's a very, very significant development in world affairs. I'm struck in particular about the Pope. I mean, I think it's good to be talking about inequality and the powerlessness of the poor. But at the same time, what about the vote against against gay people in Croatia, for example, which was fostered by the Roman Catholics in Croatia? Say something about things like that. Start actually actively selling some holdings. You know, get the Vatican Bank out of the business of banking. Sell the holdings and actually do something. Make a major statement about money and actually spend that money somewhere else. And so I think that doesn't happen. Talk is cheap. You couldn't say that about Edward Snowden. So, yes, he should have been on there, I think.
Yeah. Although, give this Pope some time. I think he will do a lot of those kinds of things. But
I hope so, if he
does. Your point right now is well taken. Did you have a place you wanted to weigh in here?
No, I just I would want to stick up for Edward Snowden, but I wouldn't call it a snarky decision, really, because I think he's very earnest. Mm-hmm. So I think earnest is opposite of snarkiness.
Yeah. I think that word is very important. I agree with you about that word.
He really believes in what he's doing.
I do want to say, vis-a-vis the Pope, I always feel that there are two kinds of transformative figures, and they're both necessary. One of them, I always feel that, Mandela, just to pick an example, is an incredibly transformative person, an incredibly important person, the only public figure who I ever went to the trouble of shaking hands with in my life. However, without de Klerk, you have to have there has to be a person who's in a position of power who's willing to relinquish some of the power. You know, I mean, I always felt that had Sharon lived, he could have been an incredibly important transformative force in Israel. You know, the Arafat, the Mandela roles, those kinds of roles, the subversive roles are pretty well carved out. You know what you're supposed to do, and you know what you're trying to get, too. Whereas the person who has to change things from a position of power, it's a really, really important thing to be able to do. And it's that kind of person is harder to find.
Very rare.
It's harder to find that person who says, oh, yeah, well, we currently, hold the advantage. But I kind of get that we can't always do that. And so here's what I'm prepared to do. And I think Francis may turn out to be that kind of transformative person. They might have just picked him a year earlier or something. I'm kind of hoping that. Hey, we have to quickly switch gears from there. Oh, no, wait a minute. Here's Zach. I promised we'd put a call on the air, so we should do that. Here's Zach in Hamden, Massachusetts. Hi, Zach.
Hey, Colin. Hey, everybody. Thanks for taking my call.
No problem.
I just wanted to say real quick, I really wish that the person of the year was Ed Snowden, and I don't agree with it being Pope Francis, just because, it seems like a lot of the organizations are really in bed with the U.S. government, maybe more than ever before, and really what we need is them to be protecting our First Amendment rights, and really it's their own First Amendment rights, and just because they're not saying anything controversial doesn't mean that they might not want to someday. So I really would just love to see a little more of a curb on the U.S. government censorship.
All right. We hear you, as Tom Ashbrook would say. All right. So we have to move on because I can't remember who first. Did you start us rolling down this path?
I did.
Yeah. So there's an essay by Stephen Marsh. I think his name is Marsh. It's M-A-R-C-H-E. He's a Canadian writer, been controversial in the past. He's had an essay in the New York Times about housework. And basically what he said, I hope I'm summarizing this reasonably well. I have excerpts here if I need them. But he's basically sort of saying, well, one thing that didn't really change that much, no matter what happens to the status of women, men don't really do any more of the housework. So what do we do about that? And his central argument is just let the house be dirtier. Don't expect men to change. Just sort of agree that, first of all, cleanliness is an arbitrary standard that shifts around with time and with culture and geography. So stop getting so fussed up about how clean you need the house to be, because the men aren't going to change that much anyway. So what did you find interesting about this?
Well,
did I summarize it accurately?
Yeah, well, I guess that's been my motto all along. So. the assumption that the women always want to have it cleaner than the men is not true, speaking as an example of that. one thing that I thought was interesting is the whole idea about sexiness. It's sort of a side issue in the article, but I'll bring it up anyway. It's, because he says, well, men can't be men are not considered sexy if they do housework. So,
well, there was a study that indicated that men who did a lot of housework had less sex than men who did a lot of outdoor work.
Yeah. Okay. And so that just made me think about that. Like, would I find a man sexier if he were doing housework, or do I find that? And I was thinking that there's sort of two kinds of ways that men do housework. One is by saying, I did this for you. Mm-hmm. I'm going to do this for you because obviously it's your work, the implication, and I'm going to do it for you. And that is not sexy at all. I agree. So, you know, but I think if men actually do it on their own, of their own accord, taking responsibility for it as their work as well, just as much as women, I think that's very sexy.
Well, in the words of Oprah, the best foreplay is like to vacuum or do dishes or something she used to say. She used to tell men this all the time. Like, if you want a woman to be in the mood later, do something nice during the day and take it off her plate. It's still the assumption that it's her job.
That do something nice for her, as opposed to for the house or for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Before I go to James on this, I want to say that so far everybody has avoided my least favorite word of the moment. I don't know how the term gendered got to be a word, but I really hate it. So I'm glad we haven't gendered anything yet. But James, as a man who's in a gay marriage, I was wondering on email, well, I mean, do you guys just kind of bypass this whole question, or how does it all play out?
It's a frat house.
I doubt that somehow.
You know, I could say that a clean house is a relative term. I mean, obviously, there are extremes you could go to, but certainly in our house, I mean, we split certain things, but there's also an interesting thing that at a certain point, I always felt that, you know, well, I actually found, for whatever reason, I actually found pleasure in cleaning and doing stuff, but not all the time. And so we had an interesting discussion, I should say, about whether we should pay somebody to come in and do things like, you know, catching dust bunnies and basic things like that. And I was against it at first, and then finally was persuaded, and it turned out to be a really great thing. And because both of us were very busy, it really worked out. But I have to say, it's something that you know, there's a certain practicality to a certain level of cleanliness. I mean, if you don't do the dishes and you have nothing to eat off. So there's a certain thing. But I mean, if you walk in every day and see the spots on the floor and mm-hmm. start cleaning, you know, because of that, then to me that's becoming compulsive. So the problem is that the standards are used in a sexist way, I think, in heterosexual relationships, perhaps, where women are stereotyped. And so a woman is expected to have somehow a higher standard of cleanliness than the man. And the whole image of the frat house behavior and sort of men will leave the beer cans on the floor and stuff like that, that's another stereotype. But there's a practicality behind it, too.
But I think there's always one, you know, even in heterosexual relationships, maybe there's always one person that's more interested in cleanliness than mm-hmm. the other, no matter what that level might be. And the person that wants more cleanliness is always the one that's disappointed.
But I want to ask you, there was one of the things there was a backlash against this piece. Every time Stephen mm-hmm. Marsh writes anything, there's a backlash. He wrote the famous Megan Fox piece that, you know, is regarded as the worst piece of journalism ever or whatever. But there's a backlash against this on Jezebel, and mm-hmm. I think it's Slate. And the fundamental message, the backlash message, as I understood it, was this guy is a jerk, mm-hmm. and he's excusing men for these duties. He's just saying, because of some kind of wiring, we're not going to do it. Don't believe him. Mm-hmm. Get in a real relationship with a man who actually is willing to split the cleaning with you. What was your reaction to that?
Well, so I'm sitting here thinking that we probably should have had Tracy Wu Fassenberg on the show, because she is a compulsive neat freak who has over many, many years complained to me about various people and their messes. And she has this sort of standard of cleanliness that approaches insane. And like, she will recommend products to me to make the, you know, the faucet shine. And I'm like, I really don't care if my faucet ever shines. And so I can almost sort of agree with Marsh in that, you know, if you have this insane standard of cleanliness, you can't expect someone else to live up to it. But when it comes to the daily chores that you're going to have to do no matter what, when it comes to vacuuming and doing the dishes and taking out the garbage, yes, I think
those are daily chores.
Well, not daily chores, but it's something that has to be done relatively regularly, whether
daily,
or not you
monthly,
live alone.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Annual.
You know, change the sheets every 6 months.
Wow.
But when it comes to those things, I think women have every right to expect that their partner, I mean, assuming they're in a, you know, two-income family where everybody works, that they have every right to expect that he pitches in just as much as she does. And I can see why the ladies of Jezebel and XXX were very, very angry at Stephen Marsh.
Yeah, I agree with that. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, how did you process this, Irene? I know your first thought was, which kind of man would you rather have sex with? But once you once you got past that, I mean, I mean, Steve Marsh, he is making excuses for men, or at least sort of saying, just forget it. Just forget about it. Give up.
I thought that was absurd. I thought that was ridiculous. And, you know, that. So in that sense, I agree with the ladies of Jezebel. Mm-hmm. But I also thought he raised some interesting ideas, too, about the idea of what exactly is housework, you know, is deciding what washer to buy housework, et cetera. So he made it, I thought, kind of. Yeah. Well, I
absolutely.
Think
it comes up like once every 10 years. That's not housework.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But also, and I think. I've lived alone for quite a few years with my son. So not alone, but with my son. So that's a whole nother dynamic is the parent child dynamic in terms of cleanliness. Mm-hmm. You know,
because you are the cleaner person than a child. There's just never going to be a child who's cleaner than the parent.
Well, apparently, Irene might be raising one.
All right, we have to take a quick break here, so we'll have time for endorsements. We'll come back after this. Not even your face gonna do some house cleaning if I have to level the place. If I have to level the place.
You know how you can tell when you're living with too much filth? Your dust bunnies have started pooping. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Corey Breen and Greg Dyson. The part of Bill Curry was played by Hunter S. Thompson. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin and appeared in our intro. For photos, links, articles, and videos of the staff of the Faith Middleton Show dressed up as mice and birds and doing all of Cinderella's chores while they sing, visit our website, WNPR.org. On Monday, we'll be back with our death-defying Scramble, a show assembled on the spur of the moment. And now, back to Colin.
Time for plugs and endorsements. Let me do a couple of plugs here really quickly. One of them involves me. It's tonight, the Little Theater of Manchester. The wonderful jazz singer Diane Maurer is doing two sets of Bonnie Raitt tribute covers with an incredible jazz band, some of the best jazz musicians around. I will be the MC. I will do one song with Diane. She's got some great backup singers, too, that she's working with, Chris Larson and Paula Hearn. And that's all I really have to say about it. But tickets, I'm sure, are available. It's at 7:30 tonight. And then one of our frequent Nose panelists, Carolyn Payne, runs the Kinetic, that's C-O-N-N-E-T-I-C, the Kinetic Dance Company. They are doing their annual Nutcracker Sweet and Spicy starting next week. And I think it's all 3 days of next week on the 20th, 21st, and 22nd. You can check their website. They do it at the Wadsworth Athenaeum. It's not your typical Nutcracker. It's funnier, crazier. There's like a whole ugly sweater sequence. There's there's hip-hop dance. I don't know what else. There's everything. So purchase tickets to that. Anyway, those are the two plugs. Now we'll move to endorsements. What have you got to endorse?
For some reason, I wasn't going to – I'm thinking of this book, Clearing Your Clutter with Feng Shui, which in my – every month, once in a while, I go through the house and get rid of – do clean up. Mm. And it's really a wonderful book about the psychology of clutter, which is, you know, really interesting. But I also want to endorse the January issue of Harper's Magazine. I mean, I had sort of forgotten about Harper's Magazine, but now I've started reading it again, and there's so much great stuff in there. Everything from an article about the Taliban to the Tea Party to how to like dissecting an insult in French to a Laurie Moore story to a review of the history of ballooning, and it's just a great issue.
One more magazine that you'll have to haul out to the recycling bin or get somebody else to do that. All right. So, James, what have you got?
The Habit of Art at Cine Studio at 2:30 on Sunday is a wonderful reprise, an encore showing of a play, The Habit of Art. And also one other thing that's really fantastic. The Yukon Bookstore has reopened now in the new Stores Center, and it is really an amazing place. It's an independent bookstore that really feels wonderful to walk around the bookstore. And a great book I'm reading at the moment, Angelica Houston's biography, A Story Lately Told, which is a wonderful piece of writing.
One thing that I would quickly endorse based on something that James kind of kind of keyed me into this week, or reminded me of. One of the essays that we read invoked Beyond the Fringe in their famous monologue, The Sadder, Wiser Beaver, which you managed to track down. Maybe you have a lot of Beyond the Fringe records.
It's actually
house,
on iTunes, believe it or not. iTunes.
But so I went up listening to a whole bunch of Beyond the Fringe. Beyond the Fringe was Jonathan Miller and Alan Bennett and Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, and it was one of the precursors to Monty Python. It was fabulous. And there's a lot of their stuff on YouTube and I guess on iTunes and stuff like that. That certainly a little sub-endorsement. Worth tracking down. Wasting a whole lot of time with.
Definitely.
Teresa Kramer, what have you got?
Well, I wasn't going to endorse this because Colin ruined it with a show yesterday, but I went to see Christmas on the Rocks last week, and it was really funny and great, and people should go see it at
TheaterWorks.
Also, before I went there, I stopped at Sunbury on Pratt Street, which is a little noodle shop masquerading as a larger deli. I don't know who goes in there and orders the chicken parm, but you can get really great miso and ramen. It's delicious and cheap, and I like it. And I think they have old cozy furniture for some reason, but it's still good.
Okay, so and are we going to endorse? I mean, no, James is not. What are we going to do about the WestJet commercial?
Oh, which might just be a giant example of smarm. But yes, we can. Let's group endorse it.
So the Canadian airline WestJet put together this thing. It was kind of a prank they played on the flyers on two flights that they had, where they met this kind of virtual Santa Claus. Kind of in a kiosk thing in the departure lounge, and he asked everybody what they wanted, and people just answered. And what they didn't know was that the WestJet staff was going to run around and buy all this stuff and have it waiting and have it drop out onto the luggage carousel when people arrived at their destinations. And I have to say, I kind of fell for this.
It was really sweet. I liked it.
Yeah, I got for fun. James?
Sorry. I mean, how does that guy who asked for socks and underwear feel?
Yeah.
When your socks and underwear popped out next to the big screen TV.
Some people got a large screen
TV. It just
TV.
Seemed to me to be, I understand how cute it seems at first, but to me, it was like a celebration of sort of greed and entitlement.
It was
being used as a campaign for an airline, to me...
Yeah, it does teach a curious lesson. I mean, the greediest people or the neediest people or whatever...
Don't ask for
underwear. $1,000, please.
Those people, for the rest of their lives, are going to be saying, I can't believe I said socks and underwear. Why didn't I say, why didn't I say...
I was wondering if the parents were all cursing them because they're like, I already bought the kid the Kindle. Now I have to return it.
Anyway, watch it. Watch the West Edge. You have to watch it. It's a must watch. And of course,
elaborate.
It accomplishes their purposes. It is viral anyway, and there's nothing we could do to stop that. I want to quickly endorse at James's Theater also Enough Said, which is James Gandolfini and Julia Louis-Dreyfus. And it's a really, really good movie. I think it's been a kind of overlooked movie this year.
Yeah.
I don't even like Julia Louis-Dreyfus that much, and I love her in this movie. She's fabulous. Fabulous. It is about sort of, later in life people who are divorced trying to find somebody. That doesn't seem like that original an idea, but it's really handled originally. I really do think it's one of the great overlooked movies of this year. So I have a couple other things I would endorse. One of them is I have a Lizzie Kaplan problem that's verging on her having to get a restraining order, but it hasn't quite moved into there yet. So I sort of endorse – what I'm endorsing right now is Lizzie Kaplan singing You Don't Know Me, which you can see now. You can hear it on YouTube. She did it in the most recent episode of Masters of Sex. She has kind of a nice singing voice, and she delivers this nice kind of languorous version of the classic You Don't Know Me. And you can see that. I think it says the title is something like Lizzie Kaplan, You Don't Know Me, Masters of Sex Remix or something like that. So, but it's not like that. And then I've got enough time for this. Lastly, another thing, as long as you're on YouTube looking for that, and this is totally random, except it's sort of the season. Danny Kaye singing The Best Things Happen While You're Dancing, which occurs in White Christmas, which is the movie that was made after the song White Christmas was actually introduced in the movie Holiday Inn. In White Christmas, Danny Kaye and Vera Ellen, was that her name, James?
Vera Ellen. Yeah.
Vera Ellen. He sings this lovely little song and just does this wonderful fantasy dance sequence with Vera Ellen. And I'm basically endorsing Danny Kaye doing anything. But if you haven't seen Danny Kaye in a while, that's a nice place to go. And this has been a nice place to be. And thanks to my wonderful staff, to the producers here who forewent. I guess that's the way to put it. They forewent to the holiday party. We're going to rush over there now and see if there's any scraps of food left for the Cratchits. But thanks for doing this. All the berry, Woodbury, hitting on New Britain.
Vernon, I already said that one. Avon, Farmington. Yeah, 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 yeah.
I'm Kyone Wolf, and the Colin McEnroe Show staff is about to head out to our company holiday party, and I hear that the Faith Middleton Show staff is going to be there, and I just hope it's not a repeat of last year when Faith and Jonathan and Lori just right under the... What? Are we not supposed to talk about that?